He was brisk, enthusiastic, and effective. The big day was November 1st. France sent Marshal Ferdinand Foch. Great Britain sent Admiral Earl David Beatty. Italy, General Armando Diaz. And Belgium, General Baron Jacques, a strapping figure with a pink face and huge cavalryman's mustache. General Pershing came to town, a thrill for Harry, and Eddie Rickenbacker, and Vice President Coolidge, who reportedly looked and acted so effacingly vice-presidential that he had trouble gaining admittance to several gatherings. 85 bands marched, and 60,000 men of the American Legion, including former Captain Harry Truman, who was chosen for the honor of presenting flags to the Allied commanders. Foch, whose presence on the reviewing stand electrified the crowds, said he had never seen such a display of feeling, such patient, almost sacred attention from so many people. More than 100,000 had turned out. Later activities, however, were considerably different in spirit. That, remembered Harry's friend and fellow Legionnaire Harry Vaughan, was when we took the Hotel Baltimore to pieces. Somebody drove a Texas steer into the hotel lobby. A crap game in the street outside stopped traffic. Eddie McKim could not recall Harry taking part in any of the hijinks, except he probably looked out of his haberdashery store door and would see some of the ladies' negligees floating down from the windows of the Muleback Hotel. They used to lodge in the trolley wires. The goodwill and mutual respect between Harry and Eddie Jacobson, meantime, seemed not to suffer from the strain they were under, though it remained at heart a business friendship. Eddie's wife sensed a certain distance between the Trumans and the Jacobsons that she took to be a sign of anti-Semitism among Harry's in-laws. The Wallaces, she said, were considered aristocracy, and under the circumstances the Trumans could not afford to have Jews in their house. But then Harry seldom, if ever, brought any of his friends home to North Delaware Street. The privacy of Madge Wallace's world was one thing, the world without was another, and so it would remain. Truman and Jacobson failed in 1922. After much discussion, the partners decided not to file for bankruptcy, and thereby wipe out their debts, but to try to pay off their creditors as best they could, little by little as time went on. The business was approximately $35,000 in the red. Eddie, who went on the road as a shirt salesman, did all he could to meet his part of the debt, but in 3 years, unable to keep up, was forced to declare himself bankrupt. Sometime later, when the two friends met for lunch downtown, Harry, seeing Eddie's frayed suit, gave him some money and told him to buy some new clothes. 15 years after the store went under, Harry would still be paying off on the haberdashery, and as a consequence would be strapped for money for 20 years. But like his father, he never, ever neglected appearances. The store had been a dismal failure, yet few thought it Harry's fault. He was the victim of circumstances. The times were against him. It was a nice store, and he was just a victim of circumstances like all the rest of us, remembered former First Lieutenant Edgar Hind, who was trying to sell Willie's Overland automobiles in Independence. It was rough. I'll tell you it was rough. The price of wheat in 1922 was 88 cents a bushel. An exception to this view was Harry's former Grandview neighbor and lodge brother, Galen Babcock, who remembered Harry's downfall coming as no surprise. To Babcock, whose father had put money in the store, it was just another case of, "There goes Harry again." Harry blamed the Republicans in Washington. The fault was neither in himself nor in his stars, but in the tight money policy of Secretary of the Treasury Andrew Mellon, he insisted. But it could also be said that the trouble began in 1920 when the Wilson administration suddenly cut government spending and raised taxes. Section 3. To his wife Bess, who regarded most of his army friends as roughnecks, Harry once described Jimmy Pendergast as a nice boy and as smart as the old man he's named for. The old man in question, the original James Pendergast, was the legendary Alderman Jim, the first Pendergast in Kansas City politics and founding father of what became a famous, or infamous, depending on one's point of view, Kansas City dynasty. His was a familiar American story. The son of Irish Catholic immigrants who had settled and raised a numerous family in St. Joseph, upstream on the Missouri River, Alderman Jim had come to Kansas City in the centennial year of 1876, a young man with neither money nor connections and in desperate need of a job. He found work first in a slaughterhouse, then in an iron foundry in the West Bottoms, a roaring industrial section that stretched across the muddy lowlands between the river's Great Bend and the bluffs of the city. Jim Pendergast was brawny and gregarious, and with his sunny disposition made friends rapidly. He also saved his money, and in 1881, after betting on a winning horse called Climax, he purchased a combination hotel and saloon, which, in tribute to his lucky horse, he called the Climax. Other saloons were acquired as years passed, these too proving popular and profitable, especially with the added attraction of backroom gambling. In addition, Jim Pendergast moved into the wholesale liquor business. His real love, however, was politics. He was, of course, a Democrat and a natural vote-getter. In time, with the hard-working, hard-drinking, steadily expanding populace of the West Bottoms, the First Ward, as his base of power, he built Kansas City's first political organization and made himself boss, a term he disliked. "I've got friends," he would say cheerfully. "And by the way, that's all there is to this boss business. Friends." In 1889, Jim brought three younger brothers, Michael, John, and Thomas, on from St. Joseph to help manage things. 3 years later, in 1892, he ran for alderman from the First Ward. There is no kinder-hearted or more sympathetic man in Kansas City than Jim Pendergast, said one devoted Democrat introducing the candidate. It was a reputation not lightly earned. No deserving man, woman, or child that appealed to Jim Pendergast went away empty-handed, remembered a contemporary. And this is saying a great deal, as he was continually giving aid and help to the poor and unfortunate. There was never a winter in the last 20 years that he did not circulate among the poor of the West Bottoms, ascertaining their needs. And after his visit there were no empty larders. Grocers, butchers, bakers, and coal men had unlimited orders to see that there was no suffering among the poor of the West Bottoms, and to send the bills to Jim Pendergast. He remained on the city council for 18 years, never losing an election. He was Big Jim, King of the First, conspicuously, proudly Irish and Catholic, with a physical resemblance to the great Irish-American hero of the day, prize fighter John L. Sullivan, which did him no harm as a public personality. With his love of good food, he had grown to well over 200 pounds. He had a thick, black, handlebar mustache, wore small black bow ties and a heavy gold watch chain, and worked steadily for public improvements. parks, boulevards, buildings, all projects that meant work for his people. He fought for higher pay for firemen. He fought the Anti-Catholic American Protective Association. He fought the reformers, kept the saloons open, and purchased another on Main Street a block from City Hall, which he made his headquarters. He had courage and a much-loved sense of humor. When a bill was put before the state legislature in Jefferson City that would have prohibited anyone who owned a saloon from holding elective office, and reporters asked what he thought of it, Alderman Jim said probably the bill was intended as a way of improving the reputation of saloon keepers. With the city growing by leaps and bounds, he reached out more and more to constituencies other than the Irish, to blacks, Poles, Slavs, Croatian slaughterhouse workers, to every immigrant group, and particularly the largest, the Italians, whose stronghold lay beyond the First Ward in the teeming, crime-ridden North End. The peak of his power came after the turn of the century, at the time when the bankrupt Truman family had moved to Kansas City. By then, he had picked his own mayor, James A. Fighting Jim Reed, in addition to nearly every other key office at City Hall. Charges of vote fraud in the First Ward led to investigations that produced no evidence of wrongdoing. "I never needed a crooked vote," Jim enjoyed telling reporters. "All I want is a chance for my friends to get to the polls." Following his death in 1911, a 10-foot bronze statue was erected in Mulkey Square on the heights overlooking the West Bottoms. A commanding, seated figure of Alderman Jim, paid for by public subscription and inscribed to the rugged character and splendid achievements of a man whose private and public life was the embodiment of truth and courage. Even the Kansas City Star, arch opponent of machine politics, lamented his passing. "His word had been his bond," said the paper. "His support of any man or measure never had a price in cash." It was the Pendergast organization, however, that stood as Big Jim's great legacy. And it was to his brother Tom, 16 years his junior, young enough nearly to have been his son, that he passed the mantle of leadership. "Brother Tom will make a fine alderman, and he'll be good to the boys just as I have been," an ailing Jim had reassured a gathering of patrons at his Main Street saloon. As bookkeeper for the saloons and precinct captain, young Tom had learned the business and politics from the ground up, rising to superintendent of streets, a job second only to mayor in the patronage it offered. At Jim's retirement, Tom was elected to Jim's old seat on the city council. But unlike Jim, Tom cared little for public office, and retired from the council in 1915, not to run for anything ever again. Thomas Joseph Pendergast, or T.J., was no one to quarrel with. Though only 5'9", he was a blonde, ruddy-faced bull of a man, with a head so massive it looked oversized, even on so large and powerful a body. His neck seemed part of his heavy shoulders, almost as though he had no neck, and it was well known that he could knock a man senseless with a single blow. Yet, for all this, he had a kind of jauntiness, an appealing ease of manner. People spoke of the warmth, not menace, in his large, oddly protruding pale blue eyes. It was the eyes, in combination with his hugeness, according to a close observer named William Reddig, that made Tom look both formidable and engaging. To Reddig, a veteran reporter for the Star, Tom was one of the most arresting figures ever seen in Kansas City, and once seen, never forgotten. Like his brother, Tom was a saloon keeper who abhorred drunkenness and drank only an occasional glass of beer. He dutifully attended early mass every morning. He liked to say he had never spent a night away from his wife. Further, as Big Jim had long appreciated, Tom was acutely intelligent. Though the Pendergast operations had never suffered from lack of money, and money, as often said, was nowhere more useful than in politics, Tom, the bookkeeper, perceived politics as a business opportunity to a degree Jim never had. He acquired more saloons. He expanded the wholesale liquor business. Brother Mike Pendergast, meantime, was made the liquor license inspector for all Jackson County, which gave him the power to say yes or no to the operations of more than 600 saloons, this naturally depending in no small part on how willingly the proprietors did business with the Pendergasts. Even more important, as time would tell, was the ready-mixed concrete company established by Tom, one of the first companies anywhere to mix concrete in a plant, then deliver it by truck to the construction site. With his love of public improvements, Jim had been known as a builder. All the Pendergasts were builders. But Tom, with the city growing as never before, saw no reason why others should profit from the work if the organization could. In addition to the ready-mixed company, he eventually founded or had substantial interest in the W.A. Ross Construction Company, the Midwest Paving Company, the Midwest Pre-Coat Company, the Kansas City Concrete Pipe Company, the Centropolis Crusher Company, a cigar company, an oil company, and something called the Public Service Pulverizing Company. To charges that he used his political power to control contracts and furnish material for public use, Tom would reply, "Yes, why not? Aren't my products as good as any?" And by and large they were, often better. Hundreds of people from all walks of life, every level of society, would later testify to the kindness, generosity, and fundamental decency of Tom Pendergast, not to say his impressiveness as a political leader. "He was a master. He had an analytical mind," said one loyal foot soldier in the organization, a street repair inspector. "He ran the organization for people. His first concern was always people. He was a man of immense heart and imagination. He was always courteous. He would always listen you out." To a young lawyer with no connection to the organization, a single face-to-face meeting with Tom was enough to convince him that that fellow could probably talk anyone into anything. "He did so much for poor people," it would be said again and again. "Oh, he was a wonderful man. To me, he was a Robin Hood," said a woman for whom he had found a job in a hospital laundry, one of the thousands of jobs he had provided over the years. "No, I never had a sense of evil when I was with him," remembered a Catholic priest. "The man never exuded a sense of evil." Even the judge who later sent Pendergast to prison would concede afterwards that had he known him, he too very likely would have been one of his friends. Reticent by nature, Tom kept himself to himself, as would be said, and this supposedly was his edge. But those associated with him in his long career, including Harry Truman, were to hear certain observations repeated many times. The amateur failed in politics because politics was concerned with things as they are. Most people don't think for themselves, they lean on newspapers. "You can't make a man good by passing a law that he must be good. It's against human nature." Politics, as his brother Jim had so often professed, was primarily a business of friends. "We have the theory that if we do a man a favor, he will do us one. That's human nature. Few people were ingrates. Ingratitude was a cardinal sin. Let the river take its course. To reporters, with whom he was invariably courteous, he would describe himself only as a realist, and claim to know more about how the people felt than anyone in town or any newspaper.
It's my business to know.
As his admirers also like to point out, Tom Pendergast was not the kind to flaunt his power. He was never seen parading about the courthouse or city hall. He preferred to run things quietly, keeping tabs on the precincts where the organization was in business 365 days a year.
Politics is a business, an all-the-year-round competitive business. To the victor belong the spoils. I might as well be honest about it. It may be cynical, but that's a fact. It's the same locally and nationally. Nobody gets a job on an appointment because he's a nice fellow. He must deserve it politically. It's the same as in any other business.
The pattern of the organization followed the pattern established by law for election purposes. There was a ward leader, a precinct captain for each precinct, and a block leader for every square block within the precinct. The precinct captain was the first person who called on newcomers to the neighborhood, who saw that their water was connected, gas and electricity turned on. Coal in winter, food, clothing, and medical attention were all provided by the organization to whoever was in need at no charge. And as those benefiting from such help would remember fondly, the system involved no paperwork, few delays, no stigma of the dole.
"When a man's in need," T.J. would lecture, "we don't ask whether he's a Republican or Democrat. We function as nearly as we can 100% by making people feel kindly toward us."
Politics was personal contact. When winter storms hit the city, trucks from the various Pendergast enterprises would arrive in the West Bottoms loaded with overcoats and other warm clothing to be handed out to the homeless, the drunken derelicts, to any and all who were suffering. At Christmas, Tom gave out 3,000 free dinners. Many people would remember for the rest of their lives how at the height of the deadly influenza epidemic in 1918 and 19, and at great personal risk, Tom Pendergast had made a personal survey, house to house, to see who needed help. All that was expected in return was gratitude expressed at the polls on election day. And to most of his people, this seemed little enough to ask and perfectly proper. Many, too, were happy to be repeaters, those who voted early and often on election day. The woman who worked in the hospital laundry, as an example, started as a repeater at age 18, 3 years shy of the voting age, and enjoyed every moment. She and several others would dress up in different costumes for each new identity. As they were driven from polling place to polling place in a fine big car. It was like play acting, she remembered years later. She would vote at least 4 or 5 times before the day ended. "Oh, I knew it was illegal, but I certainly never thought it was wrong." But for all his sway and subsequent notoriety as the machine overlord of Kansas City, Tom Pendergast was not without rivals. His power was as yet limited, even as late as the 1920s. In opposition was another Democratic faction, led by another exceedingly adroit, popular Irish Catholic politician named Joseph B. Shannon. In the parlance of Jackson County, Pendergast Democrats were the goats, whereas Shannon's people were the rabbits, and both sides proudly so. The names began, supposedly, because the poverty-stricken families aligned with Alderman Jim had kept goats on the bluffs above the West Bottoms,
while the Shannon people occupied a territory overrun by rabbits. It was also said that once on a march to a political convention, Alderman Jim had roared, "When we come over the hill like goats, they'll run like rabbits." In any event, Joe Shannon was nothing like a rabbit in temperament. He was smooth, well-dressed, and handsome in much the way Warren G. Harding was handsome. He was also quite as fearless as any Pendergast, and had both the pluck and personality to inspire a following. And since the Republicans rarely had support enough to carry a general election in the county, the real knockdown contests were always in the primaries, among Democrats, where the lines were sharply drawn. Every Democrat counted himself either a goat or a rabbit, whether in town or out in the country. John Truman in his time had been a goat, and it was his goat friends at the Independence Courthouse who made him a road overseer. So in that sense, John Truman had been a Pendergast man, as was Harry briefly when he replaced his father as overseer. The difference in the two factions was mainly a matter of style. The goats liked to win with strength, with big turnouts on election day. The rabbits were known for their cleverness. But both sides could play rough, with money or by calling out the saloon bullies. Strong-arm tactics at the polls, ballot stuffing, ballot box theft, the buying of votes with whiskey or cash, bloody headlong street brawls, all the odious stratagems that had made big city machine politics notorious since the time of New York's boss Tweed, had been brought to bear to determine which side within the party gained the upper hand. "Stealing elections had become a high art," wrote one man, "refined and streamlined by the constant factional battles." And the prize at stake always was power. Jobs, influence, money, business, as Tom Pendergast would say. It was the game played by the boys with zest, and never over such issues of reform as inspired periodic Republican or independent citizens' crusades. That the Republicans so rarely ever triumphed was taken by Democrats, whether rabbit or goat, as proof that Republican bosses just weren't as smart as a Joe Shannon or a Tom Pendergast. Years before, in the time of Alderman Jim, a landmark bargain had been struck, largely because Alderman Jim had at last concluded that the rabbits were there to stay. He and Shannon reached what became known as the 50-50 agreement, whereby the prize of patronage after every election was to be divided evenly, no matter which faction won, thereby guaranteeing that neither side could ever lose. But goat and rabbit loyalties remained strong all the same. The battles continued. Politics, after all, in the words of one Casimir Welch, a tough ward boss of rabbit persuasion, was a game for fighters. To every goat, Tom Pendergast was the big boss, while his brother Mike was the enforcer of loyalty. Mike was hard and combative, yet a charmer when he wished, or at least an easier man to talk to than Tom. Mike, who ran the bloody 10th ward, liked to get out and see people, in contrast to Tom, who preferred to stay in his cubbyhole office off the lobby of the somewhat disreputable Jefferson Hotel, another Pendergast enterprise. They were different in appearance as well. Mike stood 6 feet tall. He was broad-shouldered and slim, his hips so narrow that to keep his trousers in place, he felt obliged to wear both belt and suspenders. Mike had a resolute, chiseled look, strong chin, and eyes of an even paler blue than Tom's. He was really quite a handsome man. His great flaw, as everyone knew, was his temper. He was a tenacious, fighting type of the old school, a hothead who hated double talk and compromise, which was why Alderman Jim had passed him over and put Tom at the head of the organization. There was never any halfway ground with Mike. As was said, you were either with him or against him. He detested all rabbits and was credited with claiming their extinction as among his foremost ambitions. One Saturday he had walked alone into a saloon famous for being a rabbit stronghold, and after inviting a half-dozen men to join him for a drink at the bar, for a toast to the spirit of 50-50, he hurled his glass in their faces only to be jumped and severely beaten. But it had all been worth it, Mike said afterward. Because of his closeness to Tom, who called him Michael, Mike's views were invariably taken as Tom's own, and this gave him a standing second to none except Tom. Also, besides the 10th Ward, Mike had responsibility for what was called the country vote, the whole outlying eastern section of the county that included such towns as Grandview, Lee's Summit, and Independence. For some reason, as Harry Truman would recall, Tom Pendergast had no interest in the country vote. In addition, most importantly, Mike had produced the heir apparent. Tom had three children, but two were girls, and his only son was still in the early 1920s a small child. Mike, however, had a daughter and six sons, the oldest of whom was being groomed to take over. He was Harry's friend, Jim Pendergast. And it was pleasant-mannered, pleasant-looking Jim who one day brought his father around to the haberdashery on 12th Street to meet Harry Truman. The time of the meeting was probably the late fall or early winter of 1921, which was still several months before the final collapse of Truman and Jacobson, but well past the point when Harry knew the business was doomed. They wanted to know if Harry would like to run for Eastern Judge of Jackson County, a courthouse job in Independence, which under the Missouri system was not a judicial post but administrative, the equivalent of a county commissioner, and a prime spot politically, which Harry already understood. With three judges on the court, an eastern judge for the outlying country, a western judge for Kansas City, and a presiding judge, having one vote of the three was worth a great deal, if only for trading purposes. The judges had control of the county purse strings. They hired and controlled the road overseers, as well as road gangs, county clerks, and other employees numbering in the hundreds. They could also determine who was awarded county contracts, and for the county road system, such as it was, there seemed a never-ending need for maintenance and repairs. According to Pendergast family tradition, the idea of running Harry was Jim's alone. And, interestingly, his father gave his consent, even before meeting Harry, because in part of what he knew of John Truman. If Captain Truman was all Jim said, and he was John Truman's son, then, providing he had no link to the Ku Klux Klan or any such anti-Catholic faction, Captain Truman was all right with Mike. Harry accepted their offer at once, with no hesitation. To a friend, he wrote, "They are trying to run me for Eastern Judge out in Independence, and I guess they'll do it before they are through." This was in a letter dated February 4, 1922, suggesting the anonymous they already had things so well in hand there could be no turning back. At a meeting at Mike's 10th Ward Democratic Club, Harry sat quietly as Mike, who disliked making speeches, got up and said, "Now I'm going to tell you who you are going to be for county judge. It's Harry Truman. He's got a fine war record. He comes from a fine family. He'll make a fine judge." Had he wished, Mike could also have stressed that Harry Truman was a Baptist and a Mason who could talk farming with farmers as no big-city Irish politician ever could, that Harry was of old pioneer stock, the son of an honest farmer and an honest road overseer, that Harry was a fresh face in county politics and not incidentally known himself to be an honest and honorable man. Strong attributes under any circumstances, but ideal for what the organization needed to win the country vote. Indeed, for the Pendergasts' purposes, Harry Truman was just about ideal, a dream candidate, which is what led some to observe then as later that he offered more to the Pendergasts than they to him. "Old Tom Pendergast wanted to have some window dressing," Harry's friend Harry Vaughan would later explain. And Truman was really window dressing for him because he could say, "Well, there's my boy Truman. Nobody can ever say anything about Truman. Everybody thinks he's okay." For Harry, the timing could not have been better. He badly needed rescuing. To some latter-day admirers and students of his career, the suggestion that he turn to politics in desperation because of his business failure would be unacceptable, a fiction devised to cast him in the worst possible light. It would be stressed that his interest in politics was long-standing, that the Pendergasts had come to him, not he to them, and that in any event their power then was by no means absolute, hardly enough to dictate a political destiny. And all this was true. Yet to Harry himself, there was never much question about the actual state of his affairs or to whom he owed the greatest debt of gratitude. "Went into business, all enthusiastic, lost all I had and all I could borrow," he would write in a private memoir. "Mike Pendergast picked me up and put me into politics, and I've been lucky." Mike was nothing less than his political mentor, continued Harry. "I loved him as I did my own daddy." He remembered he had been standing behind the counter, feeling fairly blue, the day Mike and Jim came into the store. What he wished to make especially clear was not that the Pendergasts had played no part of consequence, or that he had little indebtedness to them, but that it was Mike, not Tom, the big boss, whose interest made the difference. Harry was not even to meet Tom Pendergast for some time to come. The job of Eastern judge paid $3,465 a year. If elected, Harry would serve 2 years. His army friends were nearly unanimous for the idea. Only a few tried to dissuade him. Eddie McKim, his former sergeant, told him he was crazy. When Harry sat down with Edgar Hind in Hind's Willie's Overland Garage in Independence to explain what he was about to do, grinning, as Hind recalled, Hind told him he wasn't the political type, to which Harry responded, "Well, I've got to eat." To sample opinion among those of the older generation who had influence in Independence, Harry called on Colonel William Southern, editor of the Examiner. Colonel Southern, whose rank was strictly honorary, was the father of May Southern Wallace, Bess's brother George's wife, which, in a manner of speaking, made him one of the family, as well as someone whose goodwill and backing could matter significantly. A short, pink-faced, cigar-chewing man with a goatee, who customarily wore his hat at his desk, the colonel listened patiently to Harry, then told him what a fool he would be to mess up his life with politics. "I told him all the bad effect a life of chronic campaigning could have on a man," he would later recount. "I told him how poor were its rewards, how undermining the constant need for popular approval could be to a man's character." Harry, smiling, only shook his head and said he had made up his mind. What opinions Bess had, what her mother was saying privately, or Mama Truman thought, are not recorded. Ethel Noland, it is known, strongly approved, and would later explain Harry's willingness to take up with the Pendergasts as succinctly as anyone would. They always like to pick winners, and they endorsed him. And indeed, if he hadn't been endorsed by the machine, he couldn't have run. He was very grateful to them.
Section 4. Candidate Truman opened his campaign 2 months short of his 38th birthday, March 8, 1922, at a rousing, foot-stamping rally of war veterans in an auditorium at Lee's Summit. About 300 people turned out for speeches, free cigars, and music, and to see Harry Truman launched ostensibly as the American Legion candidate, an idea acclaimed as admirably new and progressive. "If they, the veterans, want to mix in politics, it is their right, and when they take such matters into their hands, they will settle affairs of state as they settled the Kaisers in France," said the Lee Summit Journal. The Battery D Irish Bunch were there in force, along with a sprinkling of Pendergast people. Harry, when introduced by former Colonel E.M. Staten, another veteran of the Argonne, said he was willing to run and was only just able to say that, so thoroughly rattled was he by stage fright. "That first meeting was a flop for me," he would recall long years afterward. "I was scared worse than I was when I first came under fire in 1918. But his speech was all the crowd wanted. The highlight of the evening came when Ethel Lee Buxton of Kansas City, who had been a Red Cross entertainer in France, sang, 'When Irish Eyes Are Smiling,' then closed with 'Mother McCree.'" Another evening, Harry spoke at Grandview. Another from a rough wooden platform in front of the Hickman's Mills Church. And on neither occasion was he able to say much more than that he was in the race and welcomed the support of his friends. At Hickman's Mills, the introduction was made by his old neighbor, O.V. Slaughter, who had headed the Jackson County Red Cross during the war and was now president of the Grandview Bank, the kind of man who knew senators and governors, yet remained strictly and primarily a farmer. Gray-bearded, he looked like an old-style patriarch, and though seldom known to speak in public, he was considered highly persuasive when he did. One line only would be remembered from his remarks. "I knew Harry Truman before he was born," he said. And to others who had known John and Matt Truman, or who, like Slaughter, remembered Solomon and Harriet Louisa Young, no stronger endorsement could have been spoken. Reportedly, there were only 3 votes in the precinct against Harry. 4 other Democrats were in the race: a farmer and road overseer named Thomas Parent, an Independence businessman, James V. Compton, another Independence man, George W. Shaw, who was a road contractor, and Emmett Montgomery, a banker from Blue Springs. And all were thought formidable opponents. Parent had the support of a former judge, a flashy politician named Miles Bulger, who was neither rabbit nor goat, but a spoiler. Compton had served previously on the court and could stress the value of experience. Shaw was known to be honest, which, as Harry said, was considered unique in a contractor. But the man to beat was Emmett Montgomery, the rabbit candidate. Harry Truman stood for better roads and a return to sound management of county business. The most that could be said for his early speeches was that they were brief. One at a night rally at Sugar Creek, an oil refinery town in the lowlands by the river just north of Independence, was remembered by Edgar Hind as "the poorest effort of a speech I ever heard in my life. I suffered for him." But as the weeks wore on, and with the oncoming summer and the increased demands of a hot race, the speeches improved somewhat. "If you're going to be in politics," Harry later reflected, "you have to learn to explain to people what you stand for, and to learn to stand up in front of a crowd and talk was just something I had to do, so I went ahead and did it."
Edgar Hind, Eddie McKim, Tom Murphy, and Ted Marks worked steadily, knocking on doors, handing out leaflets, showing up wherever and whenever needed. "We'd do whatever was necessary to help Harry," remembered Tom Murphy, who had been a sergeant in Battery D. As the campaign went on, Murphy, McKim, and the others put out a flyer proclaiming Harry Truman the best-liked and the most-beloved captain, officer in France or elsewhere. Frank and George Wallace lent a hand. Harry's former Latin teacher, Ardelia Hardin Palmer, organized a door-to-door canvass in Independence to bring out the women's vote, a new element in the political picture. Harry spoke at White Oak, Raytown, Lone Jack, Englewood, and Blue Springs. He covered every township and precinct, driving himself in the old four-cylinder Dodge over roads so rough he had to put sacks of cement in the trunk for ballast to keep the car from slamming him through the windshield. The main event of the political summer took place in July, a picnic at Oak Grove attended by 4,000 people, twice the number expected. Every Democratic candidate was scheduled to speak. As a way of giving Harry added attention, Eddie McKim arranged for him to arrive by airplane. Harry and the pilot, another war veteran named Clarence England, sailed over the crowd in the open cockpits of a two-seat Jenny of the kind flown in France. After circling several times, dropping leaflets, they landed in a pasture beside the picnic ground, stopping with difficulty just short of a barbed wire fence. As the crowd rushed forward, the candidate climbed out, leaned over the fence, and became violently ill. Apparently, it had been his first ride in a plane. He then proceeded to the rostrum. It was by far the largest crowd he had ever faced, and an opportunity, he knew, such as he had not been given before. He was the last to speak. "I am now going to tell you what I stand for and why you should vote for me," he began in a flat, rapid voice. "The time has arrived for some definite policy to be pursued in regard to our highways and our finances. They are so closely connected with our tax problem that if they are properly cared for, the tax problem will care for itself." Eddie McKim, remembering earlier appearances in the campaign, thought Harry had come a long way. A style was evolving. Having stated the problem, he proceeded to a solution joined to a fundamental philosophy plainly expressed. "I want men for road overseers who know roads and who want work, men who will do a day's work for a day's pay, who will work for the county as they would for themselves. I would rather have 40 road men for overseers who are willing to work than to have 60 politicians who care nothing about work. I believe that honest work for the county is the best politics anyway." Running the county into debt was bad business and bad politics, he said. He wanted it stopped. Thus far in the campaign, only one charge had been brought against him: that in an election in 1920, he had voted for a Republican, Major John Miles, who had been his superior officer at the Argonne. It was the worst his opponents had been able to come up with, and given the spirit of Jackson County politics, it was a serious charge. He chose the moment now to explain himself. "You have heard it said that I voted for John Miles as county marshal. I'll plead guilty, along with 5,000 other ex-soldiers. I was closer to John Miles than a brother. I have seen him in places that would make hell look like a playground." His tone was flat no longer. "I have seen him stick to his guns when Frenchmen were falling back. I have seen him hold the American line when only John Miles and his three batteries were between the Germans and a successful counterattack. He was of the right stuff, and a man who didn't vote for his comrade, under circumstances such as these, would be untrue to himself and to his country. My record has been searched, and this is all my opponents can say about me, and you, knowing the facts, can appreciate my position. I know that every soldier understands it. I have no apology to make for it. John Miles and my comrades in arms are closer than brothers to me. There is no way to describe the feeling. But my friend John is the only Republican I ever voted for, and I don't think that counts against me." At that moment, for many who were listening, the primary election for Eastern judge was over, and Harry Truman had won. No county election in years had aroused such interest, a phenomenon attributed by some to the novelty of the women's vote. Harry, however, was dwelling more and more on what the influence might be of the Ku Klux Klan, the growing strength of which was another sign of the times. Crosses had been burned near Lee's Summit. Klan membership was growing in Independence, and two of his opponents, Parent and Shaw, had Klan support. Edgar Hind urged Harry to sign up with the Klan, to join immediately, convinced it was good politics. Hind himself had already joined, to see what was going on, you know, as he later explained. A Klan organizer named Jones told him to bring Harry in any time, saying it was all Harry had to do to guarantee Klan backing. Harry refused at first, but then gave Hind $10 for membership. Jones insisted on meeting Harry privately at the Baltimore Hotel, and Harry agreed. But when at the meeting, Jones told him he would get no support unless he promised never to hire Catholics if elected, Harry ended the discussion. He had commanded a mostly Catholic battery in France, he said, and he would give jobs to whomever he saw fit. Apparently the $10 was returned. It had been a grievous mistake ever to have said he would join in the first place. It was an act either of amazing naivete or one revealing a side he had not shown before, a willingness under pressure to sacrifice principle for ambition. Either way, the whole incident was shabby and out of character, and hardly good politics. How he thought Klan support might offset the devastating effect such an alliance would have on the Pendergasts, not to say the effect on his own beloved Irish bunch, is difficult to imagine. In his defense later, it would be said that the Klan in 1922 still seemed a fairly harmless organization, to which a good God-fearing patriot might naturally be attracted, that it offered a way for those who felt at odds with the changes sweeping the country to make known their views. Yet only the year before, Harry had lent his support to a Masonic effort to suppress the Klan in St. Louis. He had to have known what the Klan was about. William Reddig of the Star would remember Jackson County Klansmen of the time as anything but good fellows. "They didn't just hate Catholics, Jews, and Negroes," Reddig wrote. "They hated everybody." A rumor was now circulated by the Klan that Harry's grandfather, Solomon Young, was a Jew. At a Klan meeting in Independence just before the primary on August 1st, a guest speaker from Atlanta said Harry Truman was less than 100% American, that is, not sufficiently opposed to Catholics and Jews. Edgar Hind stood up and protested. There were shouts to throw him out. A friend of Harry's from Grandview named Tolliver rose to say they could throw him out too, which, as Hind remembered, had a cooling influence. But the Klan's previous indifference to the Truman candidacy had ended. He said later it was the soldier vote plus kinfolks in nearly every precinct that put him over. He would talk of being accidentally elected, and suggest that his failure with the haberdashery also had an important influence. Most people were broke, and they sympathized with a man in politics who admitted his financial condition. Others close to the campaign said the deciding factor was Harry Truman. People liked him, and largely because he so obviously liked them and being among them. Privately, Harry was disappointed in the efforts of the Pendergast people in his behalf. He had expected more. The campaign ended with a big Saturday night rally at the courthouse. On election day, cars covered with placards were busy back and forth across town bringing people to the polls. The smell of old alky, hooch, and good whiskey is on the breath of many a man, wrote Colonel Southern, a teetotaler. As the day wore on, the rough play began. At a polling place at Fairmont Junction, close to the Kansas City line, an armed gang of Shannon henchmen tried to make off with the ballot box before the Pendergast people could get to it, only to be confronted by two deputy marshals who had rushed to the scene on orders from Harry's Republican friend, Marshal John Miles. Guns were drawn, when suddenly Shannon himself materialized out of the shadows, and with the barrel of Deputy John W. Gibson's .45 caliber automatic pressing on his ample stomach, announced it would be best if everybody quieted down and went home. Had Shannon's men succeeded in their mission, Harry would most likely have lost the election. As it was, he defeated the rabbit candidate, Emmett Montgomery, by a bare 279 votes out of a total, for all five in the race, of more than 11,000. "It was the damn Republicans who were to blame," Joe Shannon complained bitterly. "If they had only kept out of things, Harry Truman would never have won." Probably that was so. Deputy Gibson, the man with the .45, was, like John Miles, a veteran of the 129th Field Artillery. Section 5. The fall election was a formality only. Every Democrat won. And on New Year's Day, 1923, in a ceremony at the courthouse, the new county court was seated. The other two judges were Elihu Hayes and Henry McElroy. Hayes was the presiding judge and, though a rabbit, a fine old gentleman, in Harry's estimate. McElroy, the new Western judge, was a through-and-through goat and close associate of Tom Pendergast, a spare, buck-toothed, ambitious businessman commonly praised for his efficiency. The huge basket of red roses in the courtroom was the gift of McElroy admirers from Little Italy. To be called judge pleased Harry immensely. He enjoyed the prestige of the job and the way people greeted him as he walked briskly to and from the courthouse. He had rank again. As presiding judge, Elihu Hayes should have been the dominant figure and leader of the court, and by the 50-50 agreement, his rabbit friends looked forward to an equal share in county jobs and every other form of largesse under the court's control. Things did not work out that way, however. It was Henry McElroy who took charge from the start, and McElroy showed no desire to give anything to the rabbits. With Judge Truman voting with him, there was not much to keep McElroy from having his way. "He ran the court with my vote," Harry later said. The roster of road overseers was filled with goats only. Goats were named to county jobs, large and small. Rabbits, already on the payroll, were always the first to be fired. The old adage of Andrew Jackson, that to the victors belong the spoils, was gospel again in Jackson County, Missouri. The decision had come down from the Pendergasts. 50-50 was finished. And though in hindsight Harry would see the peril in this, at the time he did not. He was preoccupied with being businesslike, concentrating on cost cuts, improvements in services, determined to perform as promised. He also knew what pleasure the plight of the rabbits was bringing to his mentor, Mike Pendergast. We ran the county, but we ran it carefully and on an economic basis, Harry claimed later. And in truth, the new court stood in striking contrast with what had gone on before under the renegade Miles Bulger. Under McElroy and Truman, a county debt of more than $1 million was cut in half. The county's credit rating improved. So did county services, and most notably, the quality of work on the roads. Harry Truman, as he later boasted, made himself completely familiar with every road and bridge, visited every state institution in which the county had patients. Years of mismanagement and crooked contracts had produced roads so poorly constructed that they caved in like pie crusts. Bridges were inadequate or in sad repair. The improvements made now were impossible to ignore. Even the Kansas City Star had praise for what was happening under the crisp, efficient, new county administration. And if Harry was taking McElroy's cue on matters political, McElroy appeared no less dependent on Harry on practical questions. When a road project or a bridge application is brought before the county court, here is what happens, wrote one Republican. Judge McElroy turns to Judge Truman and asks him what about it. 9 times out of 10, Judge Truman already has been on the ground and knows all about the proposition. He explains it to the court. Judge McElroy then says, "All right, if you say so, I move the work be done," and it is ordered. At a Triangle Club lunch at the Muleback Hotel, Judges Hayes, McElroy, and Truman were given a standing ovation. It seemed a new era had dawned. But the job, Harry discovered, wasn't enough to satisfy. To his surprise, he felt restless for more to do. He wanted other ways to make himself known, other associations beyond the courthouse crowd. He grew increasingly active in the Masons and the Army Reserve. He became Deputy Grand Master of the 59th Masonic District of Jackson County. The summer of 1923, he spent 2 weeks on active duty at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, his first long separation from Bess since their wedding day. In September, he enrolled in night courses at the Kansas City School of Law, where he studied hard, Blackstone, contracts, criminal law, keeping pages of notes. Only someone of extraordinary energy could have maintained the pace. Meantime, life at home at 219 North Delaware, the Gates House, as Harry would always refer to it, went on quietly and privately. Bess had taken no part in his political campaign, because, as known only within the family, she had suffered a second miscarriage. The first had occurred the spring of 1920, when prospects were still bright at the store, and nothing had been said then either. With friends, Harry left no doubt that he and Bess wanted children, but implied that if there was a problem, it was with him. When a cousin, Ralph Truman, wrote from Springfield to say he had a new child, Harry responded, "I wish you would send me a pair of your old breeches to hang on the bed. Maybe I can have some luck." His devotion to Bess was unstinting as ever. And because of their separation the summer of 1923, when he was at Fort Leavenworth and they were again corresponding, it is known how much she, too, cared for her old sweetness. "It is now 10:20, and I am in bed. There was a black bug on my bed when I turned the sheet down, and I had to kill it myself. But that wasn't the first time I had wished for you," she wrote. "Lots and lots of goodnight kisses." She would wait for hours by the front window watching for the postman. A night toward the end of the 2 weeks was the worst night yet. "You be a good girl and I'll be a good boy," he wrote. A week later he was saying he hoped he would never have to be away so long again. He was feeling marvelous, he told her, ready to come home and lick all the rabbits. As they both knew, she was already 2 months pregnant. The arrival of the baby, in the midst of a snowstorm, Sunday, February 17, 1924, was, with the exception of his wedding day, the biggest event of Harry Truman's life thus far, and the one bright moment in what otherwise was to be a bad year for him. He had urged Bess to go to a hospital. She and her mother insisted the baby be born at home. Out of superstition that too much advance fuss could again bring disappointment, there was not even a crib or cradle at hand. The baby would spend the first days of life on pillows in a bureau drawer. About noon, Harry was told to call the doctor, Charles E. Criminger, a big red-faced man remembered for his huge hands, hands as big as a frying pan, who came in covered with snow and went directly upstairs. A practical nurse, Edna Kinneman, arrived soon after and would remember Mrs. Wallace and Harry waiting patiently through the afternoon in the upstairs hall, the very proper Mrs. Wallace seated on a cedar chest, Harry in a chair looking amazingly composed. Bess, according to Nurse Kinneman, got along beautifully. It was a normal birth. The baby, a girl, weighed 7.5 pounds. We didn't have to announce it when the baby arrived, because they heard her cry and the grandmother and daddy came into the room. It was 5 o'clock. Harry called his mother and sister and told them the name would be Mary Margaret, after Mary Jane and Mrs. Wallace. The wife of a friend who saw him afterward said, "His face just beamed." There had not been a baby in the old house since Madge Wallace's own childhood. Now, for several months, until the death of Mrs. Gates that spring, there were 4 generations in residence. Little Margaret, as everybody was calling her, was more than just Bess and Harry's firstborn. She was the delight and center of attention for great-grandmother, grandmother, 4 Wallace aunts and uncles in the adjoining houses to the rear who remained childless, Uncle Fred, who was still part of the household, and the 2 Noland sisters across the street. Her arrival changed the entire atmosphere of the family. For Harry, on the verge of 40, life had new meaning. Nurse Kinneman remembered his devotion to the child was both remarkable and instantaneous. For Democrats everywhere, it was a dismal time. At the National Convention in New York's Madison Square Garden, the delegates took a record 103 ballots to pick an unknown, unlikely Wall Street lawyer as their candidate for president, John W. Davis, who seemed destined to lose. A drive to nominate the colorful Catholic governor of New York, Al Smith, had failed, along with a resolution to denounce the Ku Klux Klan. When William Jennings Bryan tried to speak, he was rudely shouted down. To the Jackson County delegation, it was a pathetic show. The single ray of hope was Franklin Roosevelt, who, though crippled with polio, made the nominating speech for Smith. Tom Pendergast was carried away by it, and said Roosevelt would have been the choice of the convention had he been physically able to withstand the campaign. "He has the most magnetic personality of any individual I have ever met," Pendergast later declared. The Republicans, to the surprise of no one, nominated Calvin Coolidge, who had assumed the presidency the year before, after the sudden death of Warren G. Harding. And though the Harding administration had left a trail of scandal, giving the Democrats a promising campaign issue, Coolidge, who sat out the campaign in the White House, was to win in November by a popular margin of nearly 2-1. If Judge Truman saw actual defeat in store when he began to campaign for re-election that spring, he never let on. As friends were to observe so many times in his life, Harry refused ever to look discouraged. The remedy of Dr. A. Gloom Chaser was not forgotten. He kept his feelings to himself, remembered a young Pendergast worker named Tom Evans, and he was always very, very cheerful. The Shannon forces, bitter over how they had been treated, burning for revenge, lined up with the Ku Klux Klan to try to beat both McElroy and Truman in the primary. The fact that Joe Shannon was a Catholic, the fact that Shannon personally spoke out against the Klan at the National Convention, all notwithstanding. When McElroy and Truman won in the primary, Shannon quietly decided to bolt the ticket in the fall and throw his support with that of the Klan to the Republicans. That Harry Truman survived the primary, winning by more than 1,000 votes, was impressive under the circumstances, and due in good measure to all-out support from the Kansas City Star. Putting aside its distaste for Pendergast for the moment, the paper had declared candidates McElroy and Truman superior public servants. It seemed inconceivable, said the Star, that the Democrats could care more about factional advantage than efficiency in public office. The record of the County Court of Jackson County is refreshing. Expenditures of the court last year were more than $640,000 less than those of the previous year. To date, the deficit has been reduced nearly one half, and there is now a cash balance of more than $250,000. Harry Truman, said the Independent Sentinel, was the very model of a public man. To even talk about throwing him out of office after 2 years of faithful service would be to destroy the incentive for a public official to make good, declared the paper. And the Star agreed, saying everyone who believed in good government should vote for Judge Harry Truman. In the same issue of the Star, the local head Klansman, Todd George, announced that his organization was unalterably opposed to Harry Truman. Later, Harry said that the Klan had threatened to kill him. When the Klan staged a big outdoor daylight rally at Lee's Summit, Harry decided to drive out and confront them. Perhaps 1,000 people were gathered, many of whom he knew. I poured it into them, he remembered. Then I came down from the platform and walked through them to my car. On the way home, he met another car headed for the rally, filled with my gang, armed with shotguns and baseball bats. Had they come earlier, he knew, things might have become very unpleasant. The Republican nominee for Eastern Judge was Henry Rummel, the Independence harness maker who years before had made the special equipage for the team of red goats to pull the Truman children in a miniature farm wagon. Harry, who liked old man Rummel and respected him, said nothing against him in the campaign. Rummel won. Harry was out of a job again, and McElroy also. Harry showed no sign of bitterness. The morning after the election, on a corner near the square, seeing a friend, Henry Childs, who had worked hard with the rabbits for Rummel, he crossed the street to shake hands and say there should be no hard feelings. When Childs expressed regret over the part he had played in defeating Harry, saying he felt ashamed of himself, Harry told him to put it out of his mind. You did what your gang told you, and I did what my gang told me. That was the way it was in politics. Cousin Ralph Truman, in a letter of encouragement, said that were Harry to run again in 2 years, he would win by a landslide. A conclusion Harry had already reached on his own. In the intervening time, he became something of a man of affairs in Kansas City. From an office in the Board of Trade building, he began selling memberships in the Kansas City Automobile Club, working on commission, which, after expenses, came to approximately $5 for every new member he recruited. In a year, he had sold more than 1,000 memberships and cleared $5,000, which, with a family to support and debts to pay, he greatly needed. Roads, highways, the new age of the automobile had become his specialty. He was named president of the National Old Trails Association, a a nonprofit group dedicated to building highways along the country's historic trails and to spreading the concept of history as a tourist attraction. Writing from Kansas during one of many trips in behalf of the group, he told Bess, "This is almost like campaigning for president, except that the people are making promises to me instead of the other way around." He kept up contacts with old friends, stayed active in the Masons and the Army Reserve. Only his interest in law school seemed to suffer. After nearly 2 years of work there, he dropped out. In times past, during the early days of the Morgan Oil Company, he had been described as constantly surrounded by people. People, people, people. It was the same again now. Ted Marks would remember him everlastingly on the move. If one thing did not work, he'd get into something else right away. He was never idle, always operating. One thing he got into was another of his mistakes. With Colonel Staten, Spencer Salisbury, and several others, he took over a tottering little bank called the Citizens Security in Englewood, adjacent to Independence. He and his partners soon discovered they had been lied to about its assets. Reporting the situation at once, they got out as quickly as possible, selling their interests to new management. No one made money in the transaction. There is no evidence of wrongdoing. But the bank failed soon afterward, and its new president, B.M. Houchins, a brother of Harry's high school classmate Fielding Houchins, killed himself in his garage. To many people, the whole episode seemed shadowy and left bad memories. A further venture involved selling stock in the new Community Savings and Loan Association of Independence. And in this, too, Spencer Salisbury was in league. A sign, many were to say later, that Harry was not always the best judge of character when it came to his friends. Another of the Argonne Brotherhood, Salisbury belonged to an old, well-to-do Independence family and was a lifelong operator, lively, talkative, and smart by reputation, though a little slick. Tall and spare, he was known to those who knew him best as Snake Eye Salisbury. Even his own sister would remember him as kind of a cold bird. Asked long afterward why Harry ever associated himself with the man, Edgar Hind replied, "Anybody who's ever been a friend of his, they've got to hit him right in the face before he'll drop them. And I think that's one of Harry's big faults." Salisbury was cheating him in the business, Harry concluded after a while, and so withdrew, saying nothing publicly. Only in private did he vent his anger, writing some years later that Salisbury used me for his own ends, robbed me, got me into a position where I couldn't shoot him without hurting a lot of innocent bystanders, and laughed at me. It nearly makes me a pessimist. He had never had an enemy before. Seeing Harry Truman go on to bigger and better things in later years, Salisbury would refer to him as a no-good bastard. But Truman by then had used his influence in Washington to put federal investigators on to Salisbury's subsequent business activities in Independence, with the result that Salisbury spent 15 months in Leavenworth Prison. In turn, a few years after that, it was Salisbury, an avowed member of the Klan, who told reporters that Harry Truman had definitely joined the Klan, which was a lie and potent enough to carry far. Between times, in the years 1925 and 26, Harry kept in close touch with Jim and Mike Pendergast. On pleasant evenings, he would drive into town to sit and talk for hours on Mike's big front porch on Park Avenue. Mike thought Harry should run next time for county collector, an appealing prospect since the job offered an inordinately high salary of $10,000 plus allotted fees that could mean that much again. But then Mike took Harry to meet Tom, who said he had already promised the job to someone who had been with the organization longer than Harry. Tom thought that Harry, with his experience on the court, would be better suited for presiding judge, which had a salary of $6,000. Mike advised Harry to fight for the collector's job, if that was what he wanted, but Harry thought it better to do as Tom wished. For Harry, this apparently was the first face-to-face encounter with the big boss. It took place early in 1926 in Tom's office at 1908 Main Street, the new headquarters for the Jackson Democratic Club, a nondescript two-story building of pale yellow brick that Tom had had put up beside the small Monroe Hotel, which he also owned. The neighborhood was one of drab little stores, cheap restaurants, and machine shops, anything but a center of power by appearances. The big banks, office towers, and department stores, all that visitors took as emblematic of Kansas City wealth and vitality, were 6 or 7 blocks to the north. The club's meeting room and Tom's office were on the second floor, over a wholesale linen supply store. The aura of the narrow stairway, a flight of 20 wooden steps, was about that of the approach to a dance studio or tailor shop. So it was settled. Harry would run for presiding judge, and since the Pendergasts and Joe Shannon had by now patched up their differences, there was never much doubt about the outcome. Harry ran in the primary unopposed. In November, he and the entire Democratic slate swept into office. Henry McElroy became the new city manager of Kansas City. As presiding judge, Harry Truman himself had real authority at last. Section 6. The term of office was 4 years rather than 2, and he served 2 consecutive terms, 8 years, from January 1927 to January 1935. His performance was outstanding as judged by nearly everyone, civic leaders, business people, Republicans included, fellow politicians, the press, students of government then and later, and emphatically by the electorate. In the 1926 election, he won by 16,000 votes. When he ran again for presiding judge in 1930, his margin of victory was 58,000. Something unusual had happened, said the Independence Examiner halfway through his first term. No criticism or scandals of any importance have been brought with the county court as a center, and no political charges of graft and corruption have been made against it. The Star praised him for his enthusiastic devotion to county affairs. Harry Truman was efficient, known to be always informed. Here was a man you could talk to that knew what was going on and knew what ought to be done about it, said a representative of the Kansas City Civic Research Institute. At a conference on better state and local government sponsored by the University of Missouri at Columbia, an editor of the St. Louis Star-Times noted that Judge Truman was the only Missouri official present who could discuss administrative problems on an equal basis with visiting experts. Every subject of debate tended sooner or later to center in the views of a quiet-spoken man who sat across the table from me, wrote the editor. It was with surprise, amounting almost to incredulity, that I observed this trend of affairs. For the quiet man whose opinions had so much respect in a gathering of reformers was the presiding judge of Jackson County, home bailiwick of the notorious Pendergast machine. More important and equally unexpected was the way in which he proved himself a leader. His first day in office, he spoke to the point. We intend to operate the county government for the benefit of the taxpayers. While we were elected as Democrats, we were also elected as public servants. We will appoint all Democrats to jobs appointable, but we are going to see that every man does a full day's work for his pay. In other words, we are going to conduct the county's affairs as efficiently and economically as possible. The other new members of the court, Howard Vrooman and Robert Barr, were expected to follow his lead. Vrooman, the Western judge, was an affable Kansas City real estate executive and a rabbit. Barr, a gentleman farmer and graduate of West Point, had been Harry's own choice to fill his former position as Eastern judge. For all intents and purposes, therefore, presiding Judge Truman was the chief executive officer. Later in his political career, it would be charged that he had had no executive experience. But in fact, he was responsible now for an annual operating budget of $7 million, more than the budget of some states, and for 700 employees, county treasurer, sheriff, county counselor, road overseers, surveyors, highway engineer, health officials, parole officers, purchasing agents, a coroner, a collector, the job he had wanted, a recorder of deeds, superintendent of schools, liquor license inspector, election commissioners, and 9 justices of the peace. He had overall responsibility for the county home for the aged, the county hospital, the McCune home for white boys, the parental home for white girls, the home for Negro boys and girls, and more than 1,000 miles of county roads. He also had charge of 2 courthouses with jails, since Kansas City, too, had a courthouse. He had the most say in apportioning the budget, and keeping the books was ultimately his responsibility. It was theoretically within his power now to award contracts, adjust tax rates, float bond issues, or determine what sums for the county would be borrowed from which banks and when. As the county's topmost official, he was also expected to be its chief spokesman, to appear at business lunches, take part in conferences, spread the word of Jackson County progress and opportunities. In theory, he had only the electorate to report to, and his constituency was no longer just the country vote as before when he was Eastern judge. It was the whole county now, including all Kansas City, which had a population of nearly 500,000. Theory apart, there was also Tom Pendergast, with whom he had had almost no prior contact. Mike Pendergast could be counted on to stand by him. Mike came calling frequently at the court, still the mentor, arriving in a dark green Peerless sedan with Jim driving, and accompanied sometimes by Mike's youngest son Robert, a small boy who liked to take a turn spinning about in Judge Truman's swivel chair. But Mike was not Tom. Mike, furthermore, had suffered something like a nervous breakdown from the strain of political battles, and at the urging of his doctors and family, he had eventually to relinquish his place in the organization. Instead of borrowing county funds from Kansas City banks at 6% interest, as had been the practice for years, Judge Truman went to Chicago and St. Louis and negotiated loans at 4%, then 2.5%. Told by outraged Kansas City bankers that he was inflicting unjust punishment on their stockholders, he said he thought the taxpayers of the county had some rights in the matter, too. When the Republican National Committee announced Kansas City as the choice for their national convention in 1928, then appeared to be reconsidering because of costs, Harry helped raise money locally for the Republicans, on the sensible ground that the Kansas City economy could only benefit. It was in Kansas City's convention hall on June 12th that the Republicans nominated Herbert Hoover. He hired Democrats only, as promised, both goats and rabbits, and apparently on an even basis. He also put his brother Vivian on the payroll as purchasing agent for the county homes, and hired Fred Wallace, his youngest brother-in-law, as county architect, primarily to appease Bess and her mother. Fred, like his father, was a drinker and a worry, and still the apple of his mother's eye. Roads, however, were the priority. Within days after taking office, Judge Truman named a bipartisan board of two civil engineers, Colonel, later General, E.M. Stanton, and a Republican named N.T. Veach, Jr., to appraise the roads of the entire county and draw up a plan, something that had never been done before. He also accompanied them on much of their survey, covering hundreds of miles in all. The report, issued 3 months later, described 350 miles of pie-crust roads clearly inadequate to stand the demands of modern traffic, and stressed that the costs, just to maintain them, would exceed what might be raised by taxes. The plan was to build 224 miles of new concrete roads, in a system so designed that no farmer would be more than 2 miles from at least one of them. The cost was to be $6.5 million, this raised by a bond issue, which, again, was something that until now had not been done for roads in Jackson County. Bond issues of any kind had seldom fared well in years past. Harry, however, was convinced that people would support the program if guaranteed honest contracts and first-rate construction. Great skepticism was expressed by the Kansas City Star and by Tom Pendergast when Harry went for his approval.
"You can't do it. They'll say I'm going to steal it,"
Harry would remember the big boss insisting. If he told the people what he meant to do, they would vote the bonds, Harry said. He could tell the voters anything he liked, Pendergast replied, which Harry took to mean he had an agreement. It was as though all he had absorbed in his readings in the history of the Romans, the memory of the model of Caesar's Bridge, the experience of countless misadventures by automobile since the days of the old Stafford, the memory of the roads he had seen in France, not to say his own experience with the farm roads in and around Grandview, and the father who had literally died as a result of his determination to maintain them properly, converged now in one grand constructive vision. He would build the best roads in the state, if not the country, he vowed, and see they were built honestly. He set off on another speaking tour, town to town. "I told the voters we would let the contracts to low bidders and build under the supervision of bipartisan engineers." It was early spring, the mud season, so no one needed reminding of the condition the roads were in. Every voter received a map showing where the improvements would come. The bond issue was enlarged to include a new courthouse and jail for Kansas City, a new county hospital, and a home for retarded children. The courthouse, jail, and children's home were voted down. The roads and hospital carried, the vote taking place on Harry's 44th birthday, May 8, 1928. It was a stunning victory. The vote in favor of the bond issue was 3-1. Good as his word, he let a first contract of $400,000 to a construction firm from South Dakota. Other work soon went to other firms, not usually chosen for public projects in Jackson County. The roads were built, and extremely well. 5 years later, in 1933, the Examiner could report, "It is now generally recognized that every promise made at that time, 1928, by the county court and by General E.M. Stanton and N.T. Veach, Jr., the bipartisan board of engineers selected to supervise the construction of the system of roads, has been carefully fulfilled. Every road proposed in the plan submitted has been built exactly as promised, and all well within the money voted and the estimates of the engineers." Trees were planted along the sides, as Harry remembered from France, 7,000 seedling elms and poplars in all, though to his sorrow Jackson County seemed as yet unready for the look of the Loire Valley. The farmers mowed them down. He repeatedly stressed the practical in much of what he said, but
He attempted the trees, and with the roads completed, he published a handsomely designed booklet, Results of County Planning, showing in more than 100 pages of photographs what beauty there was in the landscape of the county to be enhanced, not destroyed, by progress, and for the benefit of everyone. Here were hundreds of square miles, hundreds of thousands of people, each dependent on the other, and only a plan and a determined spirit needed to develop these opportunities and make each available to an understanding of the other. In time, the report continued, would come parks and recreation grounds at points easily available to all the county population, the healthful places of diversion that every large and growing population needs for its own pleasure and for the sake of coming generations. The pictures were of schools, farms, industry, main streets, and the mushrooming Kansas City skyline, bridges over the Missouri, the Blue and Little Blue, and mile after mile of roads through rolling countryside, where so much pioneer history had taken place. The interest in history, felt so strongly by the presiding judge, was all through the book. A caption under a photograph of Raytown's main street read, "Raytown, once a favorite place for assembling teams for Santa Fe caravans, also had the distinction of a home nearby which was framed and cut in Kentucky and shipped here by water, the Jesse Barnes home, 2.5 miles southwest of Raytown. A part of the house is still standing." Another photograph showed the path worn by the wagons where the Santa Fe Trail crossed the Big Blue. Under another, of a frame house set among old elms, the caption read, "Since 1867, Mrs. Martha E. Truman has lived on this farm on Blue Ridge Boulevard. She was born in Jackson County in 1852. She is the mother of Judge Harry S. Truman, presiding judge of the county court." "Oh, if I were only John D. Rockefeller or Mellon, I'd make this section, 6 counties, the world's real paradise," he wrote privately. As it was, the road system was completed on schedule, and almost unimaginably, for less than the original estimate. Another bond issue was voted, for more roads, for the Kansas City Courthouse, and for a total remodeling of the Independence Courthouse. The new Kansas City Courthouse, to replace a Victorian fire trap with creaking elevator and oiled wood floors, would be the county's part in an extensive 10-year plan that would include a new city hall and civic auditorium. It was among the most ambitious city projects in the country, and one championed vigorously by both the Star and Tom Pendergast, which meant it was certain to go forward. Brisk about his business, as always, seemingly tireless, Harry insisted that everything be done just so, and concerned himself with details of a kind others would never have bothered with. Raised on the idea that appearances mattered as an expression of self-respect, raised on the old premise that any job worth doing was worth doing well, ambitious for his community and for himself, he was determined to give the county a courthouse in Kansas City second to none. Unsure of exactly what he wanted in the new building, he decided he wouldn't know until he had educated himself. Thus, he set off by automobile, in his own car, at his own expense, on an amazing cross-country tour to look at public buildings of all kinds and to talk to their architects. He traveled thousands of miles, as far west as Denver and Houston, east all the way to Brooklyn, south as far as Baton Rouge, and took with him, for company and to help with the driving, a man named Fred Canfill, whose companionship he apparently enjoyed, but who to a great many people seemed to personify nearly everything odious about Kansas City politics. By appearance, manner, by reputation, Canfill was the typical Pendergast roughneck, a loudmouthed, profane, vulgar, and uncouth person, a low ward healer of the worst type, in the words of testimony that would be taken some years later by agents of the FBI. He was considered a bully, a braggart, a big bag of wind, overbearing and crude. 6 feet tall and built like a heavyweight wrestler, he had a dark, glowering expression nearly all of the time. He wore the brim of his hat low over his eyes and stood with his legs apart, feet firmly planted, as if braced to block a doorway. He was called peculiar and secretive, a mystery man, and as time went on, because of his booming voice, Whispering Fred. And it was whispered of Whispering Fred that he had a criminal record. People who had worked with him for years had no idea where he lived or where he came from, whether even he was married. Earlier, before going to work for Judge Truman, Canfill had kept an office in the Board of Trade building, but there had been no name on the door or telephone listed. He drove a good car. His suits were custom tailored, yet no one knew what he did for a living. One prominent Kansas City Democrat who was considering Canfill for a job tried in vain to find out more and finally asked him face to face, "What the hell do you do for a living?" Canfill only laughed and said lots of people would like to know. Refusing to give up, the man asked the police commissioner as a favor to put a tail on Canfill. But after several days, the police could report only that Canfill had lunch regularly in a booth at the Savoy Grill with Harry Truman and Ted Marks. Probably this was in 1925, when Harry was selling memberships for the Kansas City Automobile Club and had his own office in the Board of Trade building, as did Ted Marks, who no doubt made the good suits Canfill wore. The facts about Canfill, as Harry Truman knew, were these. He was Harry's own age and had grown up on a farm in Kansas. Unmarried, he lived with a sister in a small house on East 77 Terrace, Kansas City. Until the war, he had worked briefly as treasurer for a circus and for several years ran the service department of a Cadillac agency in Shreveport, Louisiana, his mother's hometown. At the time he had the office in the Board of Trade building, Canfill was working as a rent collector for a Kansas City landlord. Contrary to rumor, he had no criminal record. How long he had been involved with the Pendergast organization is not known, but according to later testimony, it was his association with Judge Truman that had kept him in good graces with the organization, and not the other way around. Harry had met Canfill first in the Army. After being elected to the court, he hired Canfill as a tax investigator. Harry liked him, liked how he went about his work. "Fred's a little rough, but Fred's all right. He's as loyal as a bulldog," he would explain long afterward, recalling the years Canfill had been at his side. The loud mouth and crude language were largely a front. As a soldier, Canfill had been superb, rising from sergeant to lieutenant by dint of his own merit, a point that counted greatly with Harry, and one that later investigators would find amply documented in Canfill's service record. Character excellent right along and recommended as an unusually efficient officer, read one entry in the file at the War Department. He generally worked 12 to 15 hours a day, read another. But I never saw him worn out or tired. He was ever full of enthusiasm and eager for the next task. It was in Shreveport, Canfill's old place of business, that Harry saw a building that he admired more than any others on the tour, the massive new Caddo Parish Courthouse, and decided to hire its architect, Edward F. Neild, as a consultant. The building was in what would later be known as the Art Deco style. Though disdainful of the modern in painting, Harry was very definite in his admiration of Art Deco. As he would have trees for his roads, so he determined now to have an equestrian bronze of Andrew Jackson for the front of the courthouse. In Charlottesville, Virginia, he saw one of Stonewall Jackson that he thought exceptional, and at once commissioned its sculptor, Charles L. Keck of New York. Concerned about historical accuracy, and out of long affection for Old Andy, he drove to the Hermitage, Jackson's home in Tennessee, to make measurements of Jackson's clothing. He would have his hero's statue no larger or smaller than life. "I wanted a real man on a real horse." The Kansas City Times declared the new road system a distinct achievement that would be creditable to any county in the United States, which it was. The Star lauded the extraordinary record of Presiding Judge Truman. He was elected the president of the Greater Kansas City Plan Association, made the director of the National Conference of City Planning. With his reputation fast growing, he seemed to everyone who knew him still the cheery, optimistic, same old Harry for whom work was a tonic. But it was not that way entirely. He had become so tense, so keyed up, as he wrote Bess from one of his journeys, that I either had to run away or go on a big drunk. He loathed the sound of the telephone, and at home or his office the telephone rang incessantly. And every person I've ever had any association with since birth has wanted me to take pity on him and furnish him some county money without much return. He suffered from headaches, dizziness, and insomnia. As time went on and the stress of the job increased, the headaches grew more severe. The telephone and headaches were among the chief reasons he went away so often, on his cross-country surveys of public buildings, or to Masonic meetings, or to summer army camp, where, interestingly, the army doctors found him exceptionally fit. One said he was as physically sound as a 24-year-old. "I haven't had a headache since I came," he wrote to Bess 3 days after arriving at Camp Riley, Kansas, the summer of 1927. "This day has been successful. I have a letter from you, have been horseback riding, watched the battery fire 9 problems, had an hour swim, a good meal, and am tired as I can be without any headache," he told her another day. Some of the other officers in the reserve, like Harry Vaughn, wondered at times why they bothered keeping up with it. "We didn't have any equipment," Vaughn would remember. "We didn't have any enlisted personnel. We had no materiel. We just didn't have anything." But for Harry, the chance to be outdoors, the exercise, the companionship without the pressure of politics were a godsend. He had become a terrible worrier. He was anxious about little Margaret, who was too thin and pale, too often ill. He began taking medicine for his nerves. He worried about money. He worried about possible entrapment with women, an old device for destroying politicians. Once, responding to a call for a meeting in a room at the Baltimore Hotel, he asked Edgar Hind to go along, just in case. When they knocked at the door, Hind remembered, a blonde woman in a negligee opened the door. Harry spun on his heels and ran back down the hall, disappearing around the corner. Hind thought it was a fear verging on the abnormal. "I've been around Legion conventions with him. He'd have his room there, and naturally everybody would kind of gravitate to his room. If some fellow brought a woman in there, or his wife even, I've seen him pick up his hat and coat and take off out of there, and that would be the last you'd see of him until those women left. He just didn't want any women around his room in a hotel. He had a phobia on it." "Three things ruin a man," Harry would tell a reporter long afterward. "Power, money, and women." "I never wanted power," he said. "I never had any money, and the only woman in my life is up at the house right now." On April 30th, 1929, after Harry had assigned something over $6 million in road contracts, a judgment by default for $8,944.78 was brought against him for his old haberdashery debts. His mother, meantime, had been forced to take another mortgage on the farm. Yet when one of his new roads cut 11 acres from her property, He felt he must deny her the usual reimbursement from the county as a matter of principle, given his position. Had he not been the presiding judge, her payment would have been $1,000 an acre, or $11,000. He was scrupulous over money almost to a fault, but also over the range of small favors and shortcuts, the expedient little arrangements by which politicians traditionally benefited, so much so that stories about him would be told for years. A young man from Independence named Yancey Wasson, who worked for his cousin at Guy Wasson's Fabric Company on McGee Trafficway in Kansas City, would remember Judge Truman coming in to buy seat covers for his car. The bill came to $32, but on instructions from his cousin, young Wasson said Judge Truman could forget the bill if he just arranged for the company to get some business on county cars and trucks. Harry gave him a look. "Son, I don't do business that way," he said, and paid the bill. Sometime later, when Tom Pendergast ordered seat covers for his car that were to cost $65, and Yancey Wasson, calling at Pendergast's office, made a similar offer, Pendergast, leaning back in his chair, said, "I think we can do that." About 2 hours later, Wasson recalled, "I walked out of the police garage with an order for 200 quick-change seat covers for 100 cars on the police register, and an order for 20 front rubber mats." On September 2, 1929, 7 weeks before the stock market crash, Mike Pendergast, whom Harry had loved like a daddy, died of heart failure. With the onset of the Depression, the pressures on Judge Truman as the county's chief executive intensified dramatically. For the harder work was to find, the more farms and businesses failed, the more his county contracts and county employment mattered. Even the most insignificant jobs that he had to give out became plums. Friends and family were after him continually, and at the very time he had to start cutting back on the payroll, since the county too was in trouble as increasing numbers of people fell delinquent on taxes. At the end of the day, when he had at last to fire 200 county employees, he went home and became sick to his stomach. With Nurse Kinneman accompanying her, Bess had taken Margaret to Biloxi, Mississippi, on the Gulf, in the hope that a change of climate for a few weeks might restore the child's health. To find a little peace and quiet for himself and a night's rest, Harry would drive to Grandview and sleep in his old bed over the kitchen, or arrange with the manager of a downtown hotel to give him a room without registering, so no job holder who wants to stay on can see or phone me. The afternoon of Monday, November 3, 1930, on the eve of Election Day, an attempt was made to kidnap 6-year-old Margaret from her first-grade classroom at the Bryant School on River Boulevard, just 4 blocks from home. According to her teacher, Madeline Etzenhauser, an unknown middle-aged man who kept his hat on appeared at the door of the room shortly before the afternoon recess, saying he had come to pick up Judge Truman's child, Mary Margaret. "I was a little curious about that," Miss Etzenhauser said later, "since we always called her Margaret, never Mary Margaret. I also was puzzled because either Mrs. Truman or one of Margaret's uncles always picked her up after school." Telling the man to wait, she hurried to the principal's office. When she returned, the man was gone. In a few minutes, Mrs. Truman came into the room. She was panicky. I believe she thought Margaret was not there, and she was extremely relieved to find her all right. Judge Truman and several deputy sheriffs arrived soon after. It was quite a stir. The following day, Election Day, while Harry was out in the county visiting the precinct polls, Margaret and her mother, accompanied by the deputy sheriffs, were taken to a hotel in town to spend the day under close security. To what extent the incident was connected with politics, Bess and Harry could only wonder. Nothing further was learned. But Margaret was to be closely watched thereafter, and the tragedy of the Lindbergh kidnapping 2 years later was deeply felt by the Trumans. As he never let on at the time, Harry was in terrible turmoil over what he had found politics to be in reality. He was suffering from disillusionment and pangs of conscience such as he had never before known, all of which may have had a great deal to do with his headaches.
"While it looks good from the sidelines to have control and get your name in both papers every day and pictures every other day, it's not a pleasant position," he confided to Bess. "Politics should make a thief, a roué, and a pessimist of anyone," he said in another letter, "but I don't believe I am any of them." But could he withstand the pressures? Later would come a vivid, if fragmented, picture of what he was going through behind the scenes, described in occasional reminiscences, and in one long, extraordinary, private, undated memoir written on two or three different nights when he hid away alone in the Pickwick Hotel in downtown Kansas City, pouring himself out on paper, writing page after page for no one but himself.
Section 7. Trouble had come immediately after the road bond issue passed. As soon as Tom Pendergast discovered that Harry meant to keep his promise to the voters and refuse favoritism on contracts. "The boss wanted me to give a lot of crooked contractors the inside, and I couldn't," he wrote. Pendergast became furious when Harry held his ground. The code of honor that meant so much to Harry, said T.J., was worth nothing in the real world. He dismissed the road plan as needless fuss that would serve only to give the engineers big reputations. Bids need merely be doctored so that the right people got the contracts, Pendergast told him. Harry held firm, arguing that his way was the best for the public and for the party. And it seems Pendergast realized for the first time the sort of man his brother Michael had brought into the organization. Possibly T.J. had been testing Harry. In any event, his anger appeared to pass. A meeting was called at his office, a confrontation that may have been arranged in part for T.J.'s own amusement, and one that Harry would enjoy recounting in later years. The office at 1908 Main was so small, all of 12 by 14 feet, that it seemed overcrowded when T.J. sat there alone. Two windows with Venetian blinds overlooked the street. Furnishings were sparse. A roll-top desk against the wall, a few chairs and spittoons, a faded green rug, and over the desk in a frame, the original drawing of an old cartoon from the Star showing an expansive Alderman Jim with a box of First Ward votes in his grip. The spittoons were an accommodation for guests, since T.J. smoked cigarettes only, using an elegant cigarette holder. Customarily, he also kept his hat on while at his desk and sat well forward in his wooden swivel chair, as though about to leave on other business, a technique he found that helped keep conversations short. Stationed just outside the office was his massive veteran secretary or gatekeeper, Elijah Matthews, a former riverboat captain called Cap, who was as large as T.J. himself. Five were present for the meeting: Pendergast, Harry, and three road contractors who were old friends of the organization and all extremely upset over Harry's attitude, according to Harry's later account, which is the only one available. One man, Mike Ross, was not only head of Ross Construction, in which T.J. had part interest, but ward boss in Little Italy, which made him extremely important. Privately, Harry considered Ross a plain thief.
"These boys tell me that you won't give them contracts," Pendergast began.
"They can get them if they are low bidders," Harry answered, "but they won't get paid for them unless they come up to specifications."
"Didn't I tell you, boys?" said Pendergast. "He's the contrariest cuss in Missouri."
When the meeting ended and the three contractors left, Pendergast told Harry to go ahead and run things as he thought best, adding only that, of course, he, Pendergast, always had the two other judges to call on if he needed to vote Harry down. From that point forward, apparently Pendergast was as good as his word, never asking Harry to do anything dishonest. "And that's the God's truth. I did my job the way I thought it should be done," Harry said in an interview years afterward. "And he never interfered." They were not close. There was never to be the kind of relationship Harry had with Mike, but they grew to respect one another. Pendergast recognized Harry's integrity as an asset. Harry, in the Pickwick Hotel memoir, written close to events, portrayed the big boss as a man of parts whose code, though very different from his own, he could not help but admire. Pendergast was no hypocrite, no trimmer, however rough and sordid his background. He, in times past, owned a bawdy house, a saloon and gambling establishment, was raised in that environment, but he's all man. He wondered, Harry wrote, who was worth more in the sight of the Lord, Tom Pendergast, or the sniveling church members who weep on Sunday, play with whores on Monday, drink on Tuesday, sell out to the boss on Wednesday, repent about Friday, and start over on Sunday? He felt he understood Tom Pendergast. At least he knew where he stood with him. It was Vrooman and Barr, the other two on the court, who dismayed and infuriated him. Any man who was dissolute with women, Truman believed, was not a man to be trusted entirely. He had discovered that Vrooman and Barr both loved the ladies and kept telephone girls on the payroll. "I'll say this for the big boss," he wrote as an aside, "he has no feminine connections." Vrooman, the Western judge, though a good fellow, seemed determined to make any profit possible from county transactions. Barr, the Eastern judge and Harry's own choice for the job, was a total disappointment, and to Harry, beyond understanding. "Since childhood, at my mother's knee, I have believed in honor, ethics, and right living as its own reward. I find a very small minority who agree with me on that premise. For instance, I picked a West Pointer, son of an honorable father, a man who should have had Washington, Lee, Jackson, Gustavus Adolphus for his ideals to associate with me in carrying out a program, and I got a dud, a weakling, no ideals, no nothing. He'd use his office for his own enrichment. He's not true to his wife, and a man not honorable in his marital relations is not usually honorable in any other. He'd sell me or anyone else he's associated with out for his own gain." Worse than Barr's immorality, more troubling than anything for Harry, was a situation only vaguely described in his account in which he had found it necessary to do wrong himself in order to prevent a greater wrong. Barr, it appears, had been in on the theft of some $10,000, and Harry, who found out, felt he must let Barr get away with it to protect his bond issue and to keep Barr from stealing even more. "This sweet associate of mine, my friend who was supposed to back me, had already made a deal with a former crooked contractor, a friend of the boss's. I had to compromise in order to get the voted road system carried out. I had to let a former saloon keeper and murderer, a friend of the boss's, steal about $10,000 from the general revenues of the county to satisfy my ideal associate and keep the crooks from getting a million or more out of the bond issue. Was I right, or did I compound a felony? I don't know. Anyway, I've got the $6,500,000 worth of roads on the ground and at a figure that makes the crooks tear their hair. The hospital is up at less cost than any similar institution in spite of my drunken brother-in-law, Fred Wallace, whom I'd had to employ on the job to keep peace in the family. I've had to run the hospital job myself and pay him for it. Am I an administrator or not?
or am I just a crook to compromise in order to get the job done? You judge it. I can't.
This and more came pouring out of him in the hotel room. He went on for pages. He described how Vrooman and Barr would shoot crap while court was in session, crouching down behind the judge's bench as Harry tried to transact business. He had actually found it easier to get things accomplished if they were so occupied. He had always thought most men had a sense of honor. Now he wasn't at all sure. Pendergast, as if lecturing a slow student, had told him that very few men stayed honest if given opportunity to cheat and get away with it. What chance was there for a clean, honest government, he wondered, when a bunch of vultures sat on the sidelines? If we only had Tom to deal with, the public might have a chance. But Tom can't operate without Joe Shannon and Cass Welch. Cass is a thug and a crook of the worst water. He should have been in the pen 20 years ago. Joe hasn't got an honest appointee on the payroll. The more Harry wrote, the angrier he grew. I wonder if I did the right thing to put a lot of no-account sons of bitches on the payroll and pay other sons of bitches more money for supplies than they were worth in order to satisfy the political powers and save $3.5 million. I believe I did do right. Anyway, I'm not a partner of any of them, and I'll go out poorer in every way than I came into office. He reckoned he could already have pocketed $1.5 million had he chosen, which, as future disclosures would make plain, was altogether realistic. As it was, I haven't $150. He wondered if he might be better off if he quit and ran a filling station. All this, he added, gives me headaches. To little Sue Ogden, the big house where her playmate Margaret Truman lived was a magnificent sanctuary secure from the troubles of Depression times. Margaret's grandmother Wallace was an elegant lady who wore her old-fashioned clothes with style. Margaret had a beautiful new bicycle. Margaret had a new swing set. Whenever Margaret's father came home from a trip, he brought her a present. She had everything she wanted, Sue remembered. Judge Truman always looked dressed up, and there was a black servant, Vieta Garr, who did the cooking and waited on the table. Independence was hard hit by the Depression. In 1931, three banks closed within 3 weeks. Hundreds of families were suffering. According to the records, in the fiscal year 1931-32, more than 900 families in town, some 2,800 people, were receiving relief, food and clothing, from a half-dozen organizations, including the Community Welfare League, the Red Cross, the Kiwanis Club, and the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army had set up a soup kitchen on the square. The Welfare League had taken over the old county jail as a distribution center, and the lines there grew steadily longer. In 1932-33, families comprising 4,347 individuals received help, more than half again the number of the year before. Sue Ogden's father, a machinist, had trouble finding work of any kind and kept leaving town to look elsewhere. She would remember being hungry during the times her father took the family away with him to other towns. Margaret, she knew, was never hungry. To Sue and her family, Margaret Truman was a child of wealth and privilege. Margaret would remember that because of the Depression, her allowance had been cut from 50 cents a week to 25 cents. And this was a disaster. Sue Ogden and her older sister Betty lived next door, across a narrow alley on the south side. Mrs. Truman encouraged Margaret to play with the two Ogden girls, who were tomboys, as Mrs. Truman had been once, and because they lived so close by. They were playmates without risk, as Sue remembered. And since the kidnapping scare, the Trumans were terribly fearful about Margaret. "We kind of had to teach her how to play."
Judge Truman seemed always relaxed and friendly, just a father. He wasn't upset to be caught in his pajamas. He was just very calm about having us around the house. We played on his rowing machine in the bathroom, and he didn't mind. The two Ogdens were in and out of the house as if it were their own, or playing out back on the driveway, where Mrs. Truman or Vieta Gar could keep watch. The house was a wonderful place to play. A basement called the dungeon was big enough to ride Margaret's bicycle in. A fine attic was filled with old-fashioned clothes for dressing up. It was a household that seemed to run smoothly year after year, with never a sign of friction. If there was ever any bad feeling, even an undercurrent of bad feeling, they certainly hid it well, Sue recalled. Vieta Gar, who had first come to work in 1927, said later, "I never heard a squabble the entire time I was with them. I have never seen Mr. Truman angry." Her father had been groomsman for Grandfather Gates. The whole family had good dispositions and were easy to work for, she remembered. They liked things nice, and that is the way I like them, so we got along fine. For Bess, life was ordered, private, sociable within bounds. She belonged to a bridge club and served as secretary of the Needlework Guild, a group of women who collected clothing for the needy. Such activities as appeared among the society items dutifully reported by young Sue Gentry in the Independence Examiner. And for Bess, that was quite enough. Her family was her life. She had no wish for more, no desire whatever for public attention or acclaim. Margaret would remember her own life being nearly perfect. "I was an only child, and I had lots of aunts and uncles with no children, and everything went to Margaret. It was lovely." The only disciplinarian in the household was her mother, whose eyes could turn steely and who on occasion spanked her, as her father never did. Her mother, Margaret recalled, was far more likely than her father to be hard on people who deserved it. "I could twist him around my little finger." At dinner, Grandmother Wallace sat at the head of the table, father at the other end. Margaret sat with her mother on one side, with Uncle Fred opposite. Dinner was served at 6:30. There was a white linen tablecloth, linen napkins, and good silver. Father did the carving, and beautifully, according to Vieta Gar. The atmosphere was calm and proper, always. Grandmother Wallace did her hair a little differently for dinner and put on a fresh dress. "My manners were expected to be perfect," Margaret remembered. If her father and uncle discussed politics, her mother occasionally joined in, but never her grandmother, who did not care for politicians or politics. Her presence was very much felt, even though she didn't talk a great deal. The food, ordered each morning by Madge Wallace by telephone, was straightforward and ample. Baked Virginia ham, standing rib roast, warm bread and old-fashioned biscuits, baked sweet potatoes, fresh vegetables in season, cakes, pies, peach cobbler. Harry particularly liked cornbread and Missouri sorghum. His favorite dessert was angel food cake, according to Vieta Gar, who in all would spend 36 years with the Truman family. "Yes, I spoiled him," she would say, "but he was always such a nice man." On Sundays, Harry, Bess, and Margaret would drive to Grandview for a big midday fried chicken dinner at the farm, where, as Margaret remembered, the atmosphere was entirely different. It was not just that her father looked forward to these visits, but her mother as well. She liked Mama Truman immensely. Mama was full of spice, with opinions on nearly everything, including politics. The difference between this spry little country grandmother and the one in Independence was extreme. With Mama Truman, one felt in touch with pioneer times, with a native vigor and mettle that seemed ageless. Mama still went rabbit hunting with Margaret's boy cousins, Vivian's sons. Once when she offered food to a tramp at the back porch, and the tramp complained the coffee wasn't hot enough, she took the cup, went inside, and promptly returned with a shotgun. He could be on his way, she said, or she would warm more than his coffee for him. It pleased Margaret to see the enjoyment her father took in Mama's company. "Now, Harry, you be good," she would say as they were leaving. But Mama could also observe that being too good is apt to be uninteresting, a line they all loved. With the Ogden sisters and a half-dozen other neighborhood girls, Margaret put on plays in the backyard at 219 North Delaware. For one called The Capture of the Clever One, with Margaret in the title role, the Examiner sent a photographer to make a portrait of the cast. Performances were after dark. A ping-pong table tipped on its side served as a backdrop. Lights were strung, kitchen chairs set out for the audience. Harry attended dutifully. "I want her to do everything and have everything and still learn that most people have to work to live, and I don't want her to be a high hat," he had written to Bess. He was habitually dutiful and responsible about all kinds of family matters. The sort of father who checked to see that the tires had good tread and 35 pounds of pressure, who had the oil changed every 1,000 miles without fail. The car was washed every few days, Margaret would remember, and the upholstery was vacuumed and cleaned, and people did not throw gum wrappers around, they were put in the ashtray. And he did not like people to smoke because he had never smoked, and because the smoke would get into the upholstery. He was very particular about his cars. And about himself, his suits, ties, his shoes. He never went out the door without his hat, as few gentlemen of the day ever would, and his hat was always worn straight on his head. Straight, absolutely straight, she remembered. He was interested in the weather, like most farmers. He read all the weather maps in the papers, and he always had a barometer where he could see it. He was a string saver. He could get 2 weeks' use out of a straight razor by stropping the blade on the palm of his hand before each shave. Interestingly, for all his years on the farm, for all he knew about tools and odd jobs, he did no repairs around the house. Never cut the lawn or put up screens. Undoubtedly his mother-in-law had some say in this. Such work was for the yard man. It never seemed like the Truman house, Sue Ogden remembered. It was so clearly Mrs. Wallace's house, and she was clearly in charge of everything about it. Another of Margaret's childhood friends, Mary Shaw, would remember hearing her parents say, "How does Harry put up with that?" "It was very hard on my father," Margaret would concede long afterward while showing a visitor through the house. "You know, my father was a very quiet, non-temperamental man at home. He got along. I mean, he made it his business to get along, because he loved my mother and this was where she wanted to live." Up early every morning, well before dawn, and always before anyone else, he had the house to himself, to read the papers, including the comic strips, which he loved, and especially Andy Gump. Told that as county judge he could have any license plate number he wished, he had picked number 369, because it was Andy Gump's number, a point he delighted in explaining to anyone who asked. In the evenings he would turn to his books and become wholly immersed. You could talk to him if he were reading and you wouldn't get an answer. Indeed, Margaret could not recall her father sitting down quietly at home without a book in his hand. He became a great joiner. In addition to the Masons, the American Legion, the veterans of foreign wars, he belonged to the Elks, the Eagles, the International Acquaintance League. Monday nights he went uptown to the square to play poker in a back room over the Farmer and Merchants Bank. It was a regular game among the same old friends, several of them army pals like Edgar Hind and Roger Sermon, a grocer who had become the town's mayor. They named themselves the Independence Harmonicon Society, or Harpy Club,
because one of their member had once distinguished himself playing the harmonica or French harp extremely poorly but with exuberance in a contest at the local movie house. The game had a 10-cent limit. A little beer or bourbon was consumed, prohibition notwithstanding, and the conversation usually turned to politics. Such was the social life of Judge Harry Truman in the early 1930s, the worst of the Depression, years when Adolf Hitler was rising to power and Japan invaded Manchuria. As much as he enjoyed going out to the farm to see his mother and sister, he had no desire ever again to live in the country. He loved the town. "He liked his walk up to the courthouse square," said Margaret. "He liked people. He genuinely liked people. And he liked to talk to them." In many ways, it was still the town he had grown up in. Farmers crowded the square on Saturday nights, but the rest of the week nights were quiet, broken only by the sound of passing trains and the striking of the courthouse clock. Margaret Phelps and Tilly Brown still taught history and English at the high school. The town directory listed most of the old names of the original settlers: Boggs, Daly, Adair, McClelland, Childs, Hickman, Holmes, Ford, Davenport, McPherson, Mann, Peacock, Shank, not to say Truman, Wallace, and Noland. Harry knew nearly all the family histories. It was good politics to know, of course, but he also loved the town. His devotion to Bess appears to have been total, no less than ever. On his travels at summer army camp, he wrote to her nearly every day. How had he ever gotten along without her before they were married was a mystery he pondered in a letter from Fort Riley, Kansas, the summer of 1930. Just think of all those wasted years. "Have you practiced your music?" he wrote to Margaret from Camp Ripley, Minnesota, another summer. He had splurged and for Christmas bought her a baby grand piano, a Steinway, a surprise she did not appreciate. She had dreamed of an electric train. "I'm hoping you can play all those exercises without hesitation. If you can, I'll teach you to read bass notes when I get back." As early as 1931, there was talk of Harry Truman for governor, a prospect that delighted him. "You may yet be the First Lady of Missouri," he told Bess. Whatever inner turmoil he suffered, however many mornings of dark despair he knew, the truth was he loved politics. He was as proud of the roads he had built and of the new Kansas City courthouse as of anything he had ever accomplished or hoped to. Work was progressing on the new Independence Courthouse, his courthouse as he saw it, and everyone approved. "From the time of the establishment of Jackson County until now," wrote Colonel Southern in the Examiner, "men with the same indomitable courage of the county's namesake, Andrew Jackson, have dwelt in this garden spot of Missouri, with eyes always fixed on the future greatness of this great domain, and with the thought uppermost to build, 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 a county that the rest of the state would be proud of." But the greater satisfaction for Harry was in what he had been able to do for ordinary people, without fanfare or much to show for it in the record books, things he could only have done as a politician. Years afterward, over lunch in New York with the journalist Eric Severide, he would describe how, as a county judge in Missouri, he had discovered that through a loophole in the law, hundreds of old men and women were being committed to mental institutions by relatives who could not or would not cope with their care or financial support, and how by investigating the situation, he had restored these people to their rights and freedom. This, he said, had given him more satisfaction than anything. "He loved politics," remembered Ted Marks, "and he strived for something and never let loose until he got there. I think no matter what job he held, he put all he had into it. He enjoyed it and did the best he knew how." He had not found his real work until late in life, not until he was nearly 40. But then, observed Ethel Noland, hadn't he been a late bloomer all along? He didn't marry until he was 35. He didn't do anything early. Politics came naturally. There, she said, he struck his gait. Chapter 6. The Senator from Pendergast. Harry Truman. Friends don't count in fair weather. It is when troubles come that friends count. Section 1. Francis M. Wilson, known to rural voters as the red-headed Peckerwood of the Platte, was a freckled, old-fashioned Missouri stump speaker who excelled at charming country crowds with his poetic tributes to the natural splendors of their beloved state. A convivial man, he had also attained by age 64 something of the air of a statesman. And in 1932, as the Pendergast choice for governor, and with Franklin Roosevelt heading the national ticket, he could look forward to certain election. Though Wilson maintained a voting address in rural Platte County, his home was a fourth-floor walk-up apartment on East Linwood Boulevard, Kansas City. And it was there, before sunup one morning in October 1932, just 3 weeks before the election, that he complained to his wife Ida of not feeling well. As only she and a few close friends knew, he had been suffering with bleeding ulcers. She immediately telephoned his brother, R.P. Wilson, a physician, who, with his wife and son, arrived as it was getting light. At 6 o'clock, Francis M. Wilson died. When someone mentioned calling the mortician, Ida Wilson said no. Once the mortician knew, the news would be out. She said to phone Tom Pendergast. Dr. Wilson made the call, telling Pendergast only that he should come at once. At 7 o'clock, T.J. arrived, breathing heavily from the climb up the stairs. The Wilson boy answered the door. Mr. Pendergast didn't ask why or what or when, he later recounted. He said, "Have you called the mortician?" Told they had not, T.J. asked what their wishes were about a replacement for Wilson in the election. The family said they thought it should be Guy B. Park, a Platte County circuit judge and neighbor, to which T.J. responded, "Who the hell is Guy Park?" After some discussion, Pendergast, who kept standing the whole time, told them he had to leave and that they should speak to no one until he called back. They waited for nearly 4 hours, the body of Francis Wilson on the bed in the adjoining room. At 11 o'clock, Pendergast called and said only 3 words. "Call the mortician." Thus it was that white-haired, sober-looking guy